Empire Podcast this week. We go off the road with On the Road's Michael Winterbottom, plus all the usual news and nonsense. And the movie podcast is feeling a bit sad right now because we have to say goodbye to one of our own. He's one of our own. He's one of our own.
What's happening?
Phil Dissemblian. He's one of our own. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. And yes, indeed, it is very, very sad times around here because I'm joined by Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Let me finish that sentence.
Okay, yeah.
And James Dyer.
Hello.
And at times we get much sadder than that, quite frankly, do they?
Yeah, that wasn't an improvement at the end of the sentence.
There's a reason why we're sad.
Is there? I guess.
There is. Because
there is.
This is it. This is the final podcast, as far as we know anyway, of one Philip Aloysius Dissemblian, who is finally waving goodbye to this grey, depressing pod booth after 5.5 years, but Philip must seem a lot longer.
It's been 5.5 years.
5.5 years.
Wow.
We've been doing this crazy thing called podding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It is emotional.
Yeah.
No question.
Here's a question. If we, if you will, filibuster this podcast, does that mean Phil can't leave?
No.
But I'm pretty sure that's how filibustering works.
You're right. But they tend not to send security in to remove people when actual filibustering takes place.
True.
And I think that's what's going to happen. Bernard, the nice security guard on the ground floor, is going to come in and bust some shit up.
I just think it's worth a try. That's all.
Okay. He'll put the bust in filibuster while we're trying to put the fill in filibuster. That's what's going to happen.
Yes, this sounds complicated.
It does sound complicated. So, but what we are going to do is we're going to let Phil filibuster to a little bit. Our art house guru, for it is he, who is leaving us to go to Pastors New. He will, the question and answer session will be dedicated entirely to you at the end of this podcast,
yes.
Phil. How do you feel about that?
I feel it's a couple of hours too short. Should go on.
You should do some sort of speaking tour.
Yes.
So what we're going to do is we're going to start off with the news. We're going to start off with the news component of the show, and then we're going on to the reviews part of the show, and then we're going to, you know, just see you at the door.
Okay.
So that's how we're
going to
do
it. Just make sure I've left.
So, movie news, Len. What's been happening? What is happening? Tell me more. That sounds great. I love it.
Really exciting things. Linda Hamilton might be coming back to the Terminator franchise.
You just have to mention Hamilton in every podcast, don't you?
Yes, I do. Her name is...
Did you engineer this story?
Hamilton. No.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, look, she has, unlike the Terminator franchise, a 100% success rate as Sarah Connor.
True.
So, you know, that's got to be worth something.
This is true. This is true. So she's been in 2 Terminator films.
Yep.
She wasn't in the T3-2 Back in
she's
Time
dead.
Thing.
She's
she?
Dead in 3.
She's dead. Yeah. No. I know she's dead in 3, but she wasn't in the theme park thing. Back in Time or Back in Time.
No, I don't believe so. Oh, hang on. Which one are you talking about? The one, the T2-3D? Yeah, she is in that, and then it cuts from her to fake her.
Okay.
Have you ever seen it? Have you ever been
to
that?
Yeah, I've seen it, but I just can't remember anything
about
it.
You get these sort of jobbing extras who do the live bit, and then it flips to the footage of her. But yeah, she is in T2-3D, Battle Beyond Time, where they fight the T1 million.
T1 million, that's ridiculous.
T1 million.
Nonsense. So she's dead in T3.
Yeah.
As far as we know.
As far as we know.
Never see the body.
But here's the thing, time travel. That's all I have to say about that.
Timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly stuff.
Wibbly-wobbly stuff, travel. Exactly.
To be clear, this is Cameron said, his statement on this was there are 50-year-old, 60-year-old guys out there killing bad guys, he said, but there isn't an example of that for women, presumably except for Helen Mirren in Red and Red 2. But makes a very valid point.
Yeah.
And she is the ultimate badass.
Although, I mean, I think that Connie Nielsen and Robin Wright in Wonder Woman might also disagree.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
If
true.
It is a disgrace, by the way, Hollywood, that you have not tooled up a Taken-style actioner with either or both of those women in the months since that came out. I assume they're still writing it and hammering out the deal.
Almost certainly.
Yeah. Anyway, so that is the Linda Hamilton potentially back in Terminator news.
So how do we feel about that? I mean, how do we feel about Terminator 6 in general?
It's going to follow on from Terminator 2, isn't it? So it's essentially pulling a Highlander 3, but hopefully not an actual Highlander 3, where they are essentially ejecting everything from Mostow's 1 onwards. So that's the thinking on this. And that in itself is a shrewd move. And I'd be interested to see a film that stars Linda Hamilton that picks up after Terminator 2. I think my worries, I mean, it's not Cameron directing it. It's not Cameron writing it.
It's Tim Miller.
It's Tim Miller directing it.
And a writer's room.
It's David Goyer, isn't it? Isn't he leading that?
Which is one of my little bugbears of modern Hollywood. these writers' rooms, which as far as I can tell so far, just lead to muddled movies.
Too many cooks syndrome.
Yeah, too many cooks, too many cooks.
Stop that now. And
oh God, a terrifying bearded man just appeared behind you.
That's Phil.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Hi.
My concern with this is that when I spoke to Cameron earlier this year, he was saying, you know, oh, you've got to think of a way because you've got to... Sure, I did that. Yeah.
Oh, you name-dropper.
I totally did. Me and Jim.
Oh, by the way, it's Stephen King's birthday today as we're recording this. He's 70 today.
He is.
My good friend, obviously. I interviewed him earlier on this year.
Good
I just want to say, Steve, from one constant reader to a constant writer, happy birthday, son. Carry on. You were saying something.
I'm sure he's listening. Absolutely.
Of course he's listening.
That was absolutely seamless. Well done. No, he was saying that you have to have Arnold in it. You don't want to have him as a central character. You need to have him as a kind of peripheral character, but you need to think of a way how would the T-800 have age? Would it, basically he's talking about the Pops stuff that they do in Genesis.
Yeah.
You know, would you have an Arnold? And the answer to that is you just don't. It's not a good idea. And I think that is probably my biggest cause of concern here. Lynn Hammond, of course, isn't going to be the lead. Aren't they looking for? They're looking for an 18-year-old female lead for this, I believe.
Yeah,
they are.
Much
like all films, I don't know. Look, Cameron's involved. That's a good thing. Could it be an absolute car crash? Of course, it could be.
Yeah,
but we'll see.
But you know, Christmas Eve, everyone.
Christmas Eve.
We've got to be hopeful. The fact that Cameron's involved and potentially Linda Hamilton's back.
Yeah.
Those are potentially really good things.
I'm shaking this present. I think something's broken inside.
And Arnold as well, who has never been involved with a bad Terminator film.
And since Arnold is not on board with Escape Plan 3, which Sly's doing on his own, that frees Arnold up to do this.
Wow, you are the king of segues. Move over Joe Bluth. That's amazing. Yes. So they're making Escape Plan 3 right now.
Yeah. Arnold has enacted his escape plan and he's not going to be in it.
As is Sam Neill. Did Sam Neill die in the first one?
Yeah.
I can't remember. Let's say yes.
What happens in Escape Plan?
Sly Stallone is the world's greatest
security expert.
Yeah. So he gets put into prisons then to so he can break out and tell people what the flaws are in their plans.
Yeah.
And then he gets kidnapped and placed aboard the world's most high tech prison.
Super smack security. Yeah. Max.
Super unescapable is what they call it. And so he has to team up with Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's like the big, sort of the Morgan Freeman, I guess, of the film. so he has to team up to try and break out of this.
Plays
super
Nelson
prison.
Mandela.
No, the other Morgan Freeman, the Shawshank Redemption Morgan Freeman.
Sorry.
It was fun as it went, I guess. And they have a fight, which is cool. And Finney Jones is in it,
Anyone know what happened in Escape Plan 2?
It hasn't come out yet. So
they're planning Escape Plan 3.
They're shooting Escape Plan 3.
Oh.
So, Escape to Hubris Island, you could say.
Maybe they're shooting Escape Plan 2, but they've got trapped inside a prison and they need Escape Plan 3 production crews
to get them out. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense.
Hugely exciting news, I guess.
Hey, can we get back to actually exciting news?
No.
I'll go on.
No, this is good. Carry on. What else have you got, James, in your pot of...
I've got Taika Waititi.
Oh, that is
yes,
too
you do.
Exciting.
Yeah.
You do. That's an out-of-left-field one, isn't it?
I'm so here for anything that man wants to make. He is apparently circling a live-action remake of Akira. Now, the hunt for the wilder Akira has been going on now for... at least a decade, a decade and a half or more, to make a live-action version of the classic anime. If you haven't seen it, go see it. If you understand what's happening at the end, please let me know. But it's astonishing. It's an amazing, amazing film. And Hollywood has kept on trying, and all of these directors have come and gone, thinking that they have a take on Akira. In the past, it's attracted Steve Clovis, Keanu Reeves, Albert Hughes, Jaime Colet-Serra, Dane DeHaan, Michael Pitt, Rory Robinson, Leonardo DiCaprio's Appian Way company actually is still attached. It's been through the ringer, is what I'm saying. And apparently Taika is braving the same ringer. I think this is potentially a very good thing, because I think if you have someone like him in charge, he's got the wit to avoid the kind of whitewashing nonsense that plagued Ghost in the Shell.
Mm.
He's got enough inherent weirdness to get with Akira's weirdness, I think. And he's bloody brilliant, and I love him a lot.
There is only one problem.
Ah.
Akira is babbling nonsense.
I mean, yeah, but also no, I don't agree. And I like the original. And
I didn't understand a word of it. This, I must
point
out,
subtitles on.
Is the first... Oh, see, this is where I went wrong. This is the first, and I must confess, last anime I ever watched.
Oh, James.
And I sat down and watched it, and they had nice bikes, and there was Tetsuo, who turns into a big blob monster.
That's
and
a
there
nice
was Kaneda,
bike.
Who had the nice bike. And beyond that, I don't know that I understood anything.
Well, probably not made for you, is it, Jimbo? Unless, let's be honest. I'm not sure this will happen, I'll be honest.
I mean, I'm not saying it's top of the most probable things in Hollywood pile, but I think if it were to happen, I would be there for it. As the world knows, I'm the biggest Hunt for the Wilder People fan out there, and I am first in line for Thor Ragnarok. I will fight you, Chris. I will fight you.
Okay. All right.
Well, okay.
You'll win. You have a wiry strength. Yeah, we're excited about that. And then just very, very briefly, there are a couple of other things. So Damon Lindelof this week tweeted that his Watchmen pilot seems to have been picked up by HBO. A little cryptic picture on Instagram. A statue of the original Night Owl, Hollis Mason, from the mm-hmm. Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons graphic novel. So very, very excited about that. I'm a big fan of Zack Snyder's movie, I'll be honest with you.
Super good movie.
I like it.
Yeah, but maybe... letting Watchmen play out over 10 hours rather than trying to compress it all into 3 is maybe the way to go. Although I'd imagine with a lesser budget, so...
No.
We shall see.
No, it's not.
Is it a bigger budget?
No, I think it's not the way to go. The movie was great. They should leave it at that.
They should leave it at that?
Yeah.
That's a controversial
view.
Is it, though?
The Arthouse feels just...
He's just burning his reputation as he goes.
That's not controversial.
Preachers are going up tonight. That's not controversial.
A bit controversial.
Give me some really effective superhero...
how long do you want to
TV
be?
TV serials from recent times.
Daredevil, season 1.
Yeah, we like
Jessica
that.
Jessica Jones.
Yeah, but unfortunately, there's been 7 since then.
Well, I mean, kind of. Parts of Arrow have been okay.
Oh, good grief.
Don't give me parts of. I need the entirety. I think the thing that was good about Zack Snyder's one, it was cinematic.
It was.
And it was violent.
That's true.
And it was beautiful.
It didn't put its punches. Mm. And it looked beautiful.
I really like that film. A lot of people don't like it, though. A lot of people took real issue with it. I'm baffled as to why.
I think it's a Zack Snyder thing. I think that guy could make the greatest film ever made, and he'd still get pilloried.
Yeah, I think that's just
or Hillary.
It's good. It's sorry. Also, there was a little award ceremony on the weekend.
Was there?
Emmys.
Oh yeah.
Emmys happened. If anyone's interested in the Emmys.
Can I just say, I went on BBC News to talk about the Emmys before they happened, and I called it.
Did you?
I called it. I called
everything.
Handmaid's Tale doing brilliantly. I called Big Little Lies doing brilliantly. I mean, both very predictable. I called Elizabeth Moss winning Best Actress. I called Riz Ahmed winning Best Actor in a whatever it was limited series.
Well,
basically, I had a good night. Is what I'm saying. I should have put money on.
Donald Glover got 2.
Donald Glover, fantastic news. Sorry.
Best Picture at the Oscars.
My tip for Best Picture at the Oscars.
Death Wish.
Definitely Death Wish.
There you go,
Thor Ragnarok.
Thor Ragnarok. Right. Yeah,
put
Thor
all
Ragnarok.
Your money on Death Wish with Thor Ragnarok coming in second. The Emmys are dead to me because he didn't nominate Michael McKean for Better Call Saul season 3, and that is an absolutely ludicrous development. And then they did that nonsense with Sean Spicer. And
That was terrible. Also, the leftovers were left over.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so, which is criminal. Absolutely.
Where
criminal.
Was MasterChef the Professionals? I'll tell you, mm-hmm. nowhere. That's why.
Yeah, well, anyway, it was a really good night for The Handmaid's Tale, deservedly, and Big Little Lies, deservedly, so I'm happy.
Yes. Well done. Well done, them, deservedly.
Yes.
They're dead to me.
Fair enough.
And it's nonsense. So let's move on to something else.
Yes. Matt Damon is making a movie about the Charlatans.
Is he, though?
I might have misread this story. He's making a movie called Charlatan.
Right. Okay.
He's playing Tim Burgess of the Charlatans.
Who... unfollowed me on Twitter.
No,
he's such a nice guy.
And I unfollowed him on Twitter as well. And then we met, and there was a moment where we went, "Oh, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you." And it was that unspoken thing, like you.
Yeah.
I know you unfollowed me.
There
Burgess.
Must be so much drama between you.
It was a crackling moment of electricity. You know, he's the only one I know from the Charlatans.
Wow, my friend loved him.
That's an amazing Charlatans joke, by the way.
My friend loved him so much. As a teenager, that she named her shell-toed Adidas after him. They were Tim and Burgess. I'm not kidding.
Really?
Yeah. Hey, Helen, if you're listening, and that's not talking about myself in the third person, that's another person called Helen.
I can't top that. And we should move on.
Well, Phil, we haven't said what
it is. So tell me about Charlatan.
This is glib and flippant. It's based on a book called Charlatan, with the pithy subhead, America's Most Dangerous Huckster, The Man Who Pursued Him, and The Age of Flim Flam. It comes in a poster-sized book, obviously.
So it's about
a title on that.
What, Donald Trump, then?
It's about a man, a doctor called John R. Brinkley, who set up a clinic in Kansas.
Ah, yes.
Missouri in 1918.
Testicles. That's where you're going, right?
I'm heading down that way, yeah. Yeah. I certainly am. Goat testicles. To cure male impotence. So it's a sort of a shyster story. It seems like a good time for a shyster story, doesn't it?
It does, American, weirdly. Yes, yeah, funny that. American
Isn't it just the informant? Or no, am I, oh, I
no this is else. A okay. doctor who literally tried to, you know, transplant goat testicles onto people to cure impotence.
We've all been there. Not with the impotence thing. I have to make that absolutely clear. Okay, we should move on to this week's guest because we want to get through the reviews and then get this man grilled.
Sure.
So this week's guest is one of our most prolific and versatile directors. His love of music is runs through his films like the name Blackpool through a stick of rock that you would buy in, I don't know, Brighton or Bournemouth or somewhere like that. He is, of course, Michael Winterbottom when he's not gallivanting around Spain or Italy with Rob Brydon and Steve Coogan on the Trip series. He's making films like Nine Songs and 24-Hour Party People and In This World and A Mighty Heart and The Killer Inside Me and all sorts of stuff. And his new film is called On the Road, and it follows the band Wolf Alice on a recent tour. We sent along John Nugent to talk to Michael Winterbottom. It's happening after this is recorded, but I assume everything's gone well, so do please enjoy.
Michael Winterbottom, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you, sir?
Good.
Thank you for being here.
So you're the last person today, so I'm feeling very happy.
You're relieved to see me.
I've got a new energy.
I'm glad to hear it. We'll keep it short. We are here to talk about your new film, On the Road. It weaves a sort of fictional love story into a rock documentary with the band Wolf Alice. Can you talk a little bit about this, the genesis of this project? Did Wolf Alice approach you, or did you approach them? How did it start?
No, we were kind of, the starting point was like, let's do a film about a band on tour. I knew that we wanted to do it on a tour bus, so a band that's kind of like doing a kind of classic old fashioned tour, really going around city to city. Wanted a young band, wanted a band that, you know, were a good live band. And Wolf Alice seemed like a good choice. We started by asking, you know, people we know, you know, in the music business, and kind of realised quite quickly, like, quite a lot of bands, as you get a certain level, they start flying in because the venue's big enough, they just fly in and fly out. And then other bands, they're like too small, the venues are too small to support a bus, so they're like in a little van or a spur van. Mm. So actually it's only kind of middle band that of people that kind of hit that area. And, you know, then we you know, I sort of knew Wolf Alice a little bit because I used to live next door to the bass guitarist Theo.
Oh, right.
And my daughter was in his class at school, so I'd heard a little bit more about them. Yeah. And we met up with Tav, their manager, and he was up for it, and the band were up for it, so we thought it'd be a good choice.
Interesting. And is it their first big tour? Like their
no, I mean, so it's their, they'd only had one album. So, it's, yeah. So the good thing from our point of view is that they are a really great live band. Yeah, they won like some, you know, sort of various awards for live. So, but they only had one album, but they'd been touring for a while. So they had a really kind of great sort of following. So all the venues were packed of people who not only were like fans of Wolf Alice, but they really knew all the songs because they'd basically been touring the same songs for a while. So, so I think they'd sort of, you know, they worked really hard to build up a kind of live following. So from the point of view from the gigs, it was great because you had each audience was really kind of, really kind of enjoyed it and gave a sort of energy.
Mm.
But as Joel, the drummer, says at one point in the film, he's like, that's the hour. That it's all about that 1 hour. Then you have the other 23 hours, which is the tour. And in a way, the starting point for me was the tour. It's like, well, it must be quite a weird world living on a bus, traveling every day, doing the same thing every day, but a different city. That was the starting point. So that was the real kind of starting point for what I was interested in.
Yeah. So, yeah, you have Leah, who plays Estelle, who's the fictional character, one of the fictional characters who works for the band's management. And there are scenes where it seems like she's literally working for the band. I mean, she brings them towels quite often. I mean, did it feel like the sort of lines between fiction and reality were blurring a lot.
Well, that's what that was the idea. So, I mean, really with Leah and James, who plays Joe, who's also part of the crew, the idea was that they would, for the whole of the tour, which is like 3.5 weeks, that they would be Joe and Estelle. They would always be in character and they would do their jobs. Now, in a way, Leah was quite lucky because Estelle's job was like, the idea was she just started working for the management. So they'd like send her out on tour, really as a bit of work experience and to help out the band where she could. Mm. So a lot of her job was just hanging out with the band and taking them to radio interviews, whatever. Mm. Whereas James, his job was to like lug the gear out of the truck every morning, set it, and help the crew set it up. So he was doing that like every day, like kind of having to help them get the gear out and into the venue and then hanging around whilst they're sound checking, then getting the gear out at the end of the gig and taking quite a lot of teasing from the crew as well for not knowing what he was up to. So poor James had a lot more slog than Leah had to do.
So were they were literally doing the work then?
I mean, obviously, so James couldn't, like, so the idea is like Joe, the character James plays, is like the kind of the most junior member in the crew, right. So helping out on the with the kit. So it was basically a lot of lifting and pushing and lugging, really. And then the sort of typical teasing and abuse you might get from a crew.
Yeah, there's some good sort of coach banter at the start of the film.
Some of those things were things people said to us already, before we started filming, which we then wanted to get in. But then mostly the one or two things that in that first kind of day or two where we just wanted to make sure we sort of set up the parameters that we'd been told about, but then really after that we just thought the best thing is that we just let the actors get on with it, playing their characters, doing their jobs, and we would just try and then film everything in a kind of observational documentary way.
Yeah.
And the idea with having the two actors wasn't so much to give a sort of story, their story, separate to the world of the boss and the world of the tour. It was more to use them as a point of view in. So there's a personal side to it. So rather than it being just a sort of a kind of objective thing where everyone's equal, it's just following this tour from the outside, it felt that we saw it from, particularly from like Estelle's point of view, and that we, so in our film we could have moments, I think a part of the experience of being on tour, like moments when you're missing your family back at home, or moments when you're all alone and bit down, moments when you're getting to become friends with people, moments where you're falling in love with someone or having sex with someone, all those kind of intimate private things that are obviously a massive part about living on a bus and living on tour, but which I didn't think we'd get from strictly the documentary bits.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and it really does capture the sort of life spent on the road. Were you actually on the coach itself?
We were living with, me and the crew were living on the bus as well. So Wolf and Ice were like at that point where some bands have two buses and some bands have one bus, and they were like, they weren't quite sure for this tour whether they would have a second bus. So we said, okay, well, we're going to come on with you, so let's have a second bus.
Yeah.
We had like 12 bunks, and I foolishly volunteered to have the bottom bunk, which meant that you sort of like got on the floor and rolled into it, and the roof of the bunk is like 3 inches above your nose. So when you wake up in the morning, it's like you're like in a little coffin and you've got to like climb out. I personally found the experience of living on a bus pretty horrific.
Yeah. I mean, were there any snorers on the bus?
There were a lot of snorers. And were there any people who weren't snoring on the bus? That is more a question. And what I found was like when the bus is moving, I could sleep pretty well. You've got the movement of the bus and the noise of the bus. But then whenever it parked up somehow, it always managed to seem to be awake about 5:30 in the morning, at which point there's lots of snoring, but you want to be quiet because you don't want to wake someone up.
Yeah.
So you like crawl out, creep out, and then wander the streets of Manchester or Belfast or wherever looking for some coffee bar to sit in till the venue opens, because the venue doesn't open till 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
And then you go at 9 o'clock in some dusty old venue and try and have your shower.
So the life of a touring musician is maybe not one for you.
Well, the bands, we because our characters are like in the crew, so the rhythm of our characters and also of our crew was a little bit more connected to the crew than the band in a way, because the band obviously can get up like at midday or whatever ready for the sound check, whereas the crew have got to get the gear in, so they've got to get they're getting the gear in from about 9 o'clock onwards, and then they've got to set up, and then they've got the sound check, then they've got they've got the gig, and then they're getting the gear out at sort of 10, 11 through to midnight, and then you're travelling. So the rhythm was a little bit more dictated by crew than the band.
Yeah.
So I'm sure the band had, I mean, look Estelle's character takes us in, and gradually the idea is that gradually in the film Estelle gets another band and we get another band with Estelle.
Yeah.
But I think even for the band it's a pretty grinding experience.
Yeah, you definitely pick that up. I noticed, I mean, your actors often improvised, but I'm guessing you and the crew had to be pretty sort of improvisational as well, and sort of filming on the fly. I mean, did it require you to be quite nimble?
Yeah, you had to be very, there's kind of complicated in the venue, because the venues can be quite large. So it's quite, if you're a small crew, we're a small crew. So it's quite complicated in the venue, and obviously you've got all the music. So you've got the sound side is quite complicated for the sound guy. But then the bus itself is quite complicated because it's so small. Yeah, so you had kind of both problems in a way. And James Clark, who's the main camera guy, you know, I've worked with a lot before, and he's a great handheld operator. So he's brilliant. And, you know, and so, you know, to some extent, really the kind of thing is just to try and like keep out of people's way to be able to, you know, which is tricky on a bus. There's not a lot of places to go to on a bus to get out of the way. So it's like trying to find a rhythm and a routine for that. And, you know, I've worked with James on, you know, projects not that dissimilar to that before. So we all, and Anthony Wilcox was producing it, was on the bus, you know, we worked together a lot on similar things. So like we knew, you know, most of us in the crew knew each other, and we had a kind of, you know, had a rough idea of how to work. But, you know, having done a lot of road movies and done a lot of, you know, films, which we sort of similar, the actual experience of being on tour on a bus was way more extreme. The nature of the kind of the rhythm of it for the crew of the band who we were having to echo was kind of much more hard work than the normal ship.
Interesting. I mean, as you say, you've had a bit of experience in this sort of thing. You did a sort of gig movie of a sort with 9 songs. I mean, it had gig footage and fictional narrative. Did that experience inform this experience at all?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, the starting point with 9 songs was more kind of, you know, was more the relationship. You know, it's like it's about a guy looking back on a relationship that's over, and he was in love with a girl, but maybe the girl wasn't in love with him, and it's finished, and she's left him. And it was really like, you know, why can't you show sex in a film was part of the starting point. Right. If you're doing a love story, being in bed with someone is a really important part of falling in love with someone. And if you can't show it properly, you can't really ever capture that. But it was also a feeling like that films also stick a load of narrative into love stories and have a happy ending, which is not, it seems to me, not particularly relevant to a lot of, you know, what it feels like to be in love. Whereas music, I think, is brilliant at capturing the emotion of being in love. So we use the music both to like give us that kind of the mood of being in love, and but also just as a sort of like a kind of counterpoint to it, because I think music is brilliant at capturing, capturing how you feel when you're either in love or you've been in love with someone, you remember someone. Whereas in On the Road, it was the opposite. In a way, the relationship, I wasn't really interested in the relationship like for itself as a sort of that, you know, it sounds odd to say that, but it felt to me it's more, I wanted it to be part of the world of the tour, really. The reason I wanted to have them have a relationship in it, because I felt like that is, you know, that is an element of being away from home, an element of being, you know, sort of in working, such living in such close quarters and working with people and endlessly touring with them, that your personal relationships, friendships and love and sex, all that has to somehow exist in this world. And so I didn't want it to not have that in the film. I felt you wanted to really capture being on tour, you had to have some strand that connected with that, and I didn't think we were going to suddenly get access to Wolf House's private moments.
Yeah, I guess that's a bit of a trickier thing to film. I imagine with a project like this, you must have hundreds of hours of footage. What on earth was the editing process like?
Complicated. I mean, we shot about 16 gigs, yeah. So we didn't shoot every song every time, but we shot most of them. So you have all that footage. We were two cameras, but like in the gigs, we often had 3 cameras and occasionally 4 or 5. So there's that material. And then obviously on the sound side in the gigs, there's, you know, we started off like with a few technical glitches and we were just getting stereo feeds, but then sort of quite soon in, we were getting the multi-track feed from the mixing desk as well. So in post, you had all the sound, a lot of sound material as well. In terms of the, you know, the filming of the tour, the kind of non-music, non-performance bits, you know, we would shoot sort of 8 or 9 hours a day, perhaps. So it's not, you know, it wasn't a huge amount. And the complication, in a way, with On the Road compared to some of the other films done in similar styles, is that because you're moving every day, so it was like, you know, you every day was Belfast, or it was Dublin, or it was Liverpool or Manchester, it meant the material you're shooting was only relevant to that day. So and it was a sort of story which would, the idea was unfolded. So, you know, Estelle's new when she arrives, and then she gradually gets to know people, she gradually gets to know the band, and by the time she gets to the end of the tour, she knows everyone, and then it's over with. Mm. So it meant that each day you only had the choice of that day's material, which actually kind of, you know, weirdly is quite complicated then for the film, because, you know, you might have little moments you like here, but you couldn't transpose them somewhere else. You know, it was about, you know, it's a kind of like observational documentary in that sense. So you only had a certain amount of material for, you know, a few hours of material for each kind of section of the film, and you had to stick to that story order. So it was more like about rhythm and like how to kind of like play around with, like, you know, sort of how much you repeat the rhythm each day. And for me, that was a really important part of it, because it felt to me like, you know, having been on the tour, that one of the elements is that, you know, is that, you know, it's like a kind of very extreme form of everyone's life. Everyone has quite a repetitive life. You know, you get up, you have breakfast, you go to work, get back, you have your tea, go out for a drink, whatever, you go back to sleep. But when you're on tour, it really emphasizes how repetitive life is. That, you know, that cycle is exactly the same thing each day. It's just a different place. And I like that. And so I wanted that to be a lot of the film, but it's just a question of how much you can get away with it before people are like, okay, stop, that's enough.
Yeah, yeah. I did read somewhere that the On the Road wasn't the original title. Are you able to talk about the title at all?
Well, the title was tricky, and I'm not a massive fan of it. I was it just felt to me, you know, the starting point was like that being on tour. In the end, That felt to me that, you know, so On the Road at one level is very prosaic, obviously, but it is what it's about. It's about the tour, and it is, you know, it is a road movie. It's very much about that. But also, you know, obviously On the Road is also the title of a Jack Kerouac book, and in the end, you know, Wolf Alice, is they borrowed their name from Angela Carter,
right,
short story.
Right.
So I thought, okay, that's justification enough. We'll have a literary reference in our title.
Yeah, fair enough. I did read, I think I heard some, I can't remember where I saw it, but I saw Theo from Wolf Alice describe quite self-deprecatingly how the band sort of slowly emerged as the dickheads that we are. How did the band sort of handle having a camera crew in their face?
Well, I'm sure it's like strange for them and for the crew. I think probably the crew were a little bit resistant when they heard that was the idea.
Yeah.
And we were probably slightly more with the crew, especially early on. Then, you know, then as I say, as the character Estelle gets to know the band more, we kind of gradually drift more into the band's world. I mean, look, I think Wolf Eye is a great live band, and I also think they're a nice bunch of people, and the kind of dynamic between them, you know, is enjoyable. And so I think, you know, I hope, you know, that they recognise that. I hope the film kind of shows that, you know. And I think we showed it at the film festival last year, to be honest, and they were there with a lot of their kind of mates, and I think they all enjoyed it.
Yeah,
you know, I think, you know, they seem, you know, they seem like what they are. Like, they take the music really seriously. They work really hard, but also they have fun. And they're you know, a bunch of people who, I guess, 4 years ago, or whatever, were like playing by themselves in their you know, bedroom or garage, or whatever, hoping to be able to kind of find an audience. And then when we were filming them, I think it was a great moment where they got this kind of fan base, they got this following, they had this, you know, really enthusiastic crowds who knew their music and really loved their music. But at the same time, they could go out and have a drink in the bar next door and not worry about it and mess around and still be, you know, still be kind of, you know, like the fans themselves, you know, still be part of that world. Yeah. And I think, you know, if you caught a band's, like, I'm sure they won't get like this, but I think you get a band that's been doing it for 2 or 3 years more or whatever, a bit bigger, a bit more money, then suddenly you get this big kind of gap between the band and the fans, and they're insulated and isolated. And I think the kind of world that they were living in on this tour was a, you know, really fun world for them and a good world for us to film.
Yeah. Music has always played a massive part in your career. Have you ever considered doing a full-on musical?
No, I'd like to, actually, but we never like tried to do one. But I think musicals, I mean, the musicals can be fun. I mean, it depends what sort of musical you mean.
I guess you have quite a naturalistic style, so maybe that doesn't fit in with people bursting into song. And
no, maybe not. I don't know. I mean, because when I saw La La Land, I thought, before I saw La La Land, I thought it was going to be very kind of naturalistic, and then the music somehow would be, like, you know, integrated with that. Whereas in fact, it was kind of quite an old-fashioned musical, I thought. But I think, you know, it's like, look, music in any film, like whether it's about bands or it's about music or not, the music in the film is always hugely important, and almost, you know, all films kind of depend a lot on the score and that. So it's always fun to play around with it. But we haven't got any particular project in mind.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Shirley Henderson makes a cameo in this film. Brilliant. It's only 5 minutes and does amazing work with those 5 minutes. And she's obviously a regular collaborator with you. Would you say you've established a sort of rep theatre company with
No, I wish I had. I don't think I have. I mean, we had to a large extent, we've done that with crew over the years. Like, when we started off, it was like, you know, there was like, you know, me and Andrew had a company, but the films would be like pretty traditional films where you'd suddenly have 100 people on set and you wouldn't really know anyone, and you'd do it for 7 or 8 weeks and be very unhappy and stressed, and then you stop. And then, you know, from now for a long time, you know, kind of tried to like make the filming as simple as possible, keep the crew small, but also keep a continuity. So it's not like it's the same crew each time, but there's a lot of overlap between, you know, people from one shoot to the next. So that side of it, you know, like both the kind of like, you know, the development side and the post side, but also on the crew side, there feels there's a kind of rep company in that area. It's harder with actors. I mean, probably because, you know, we do quite a wide variety of films, so often they're like mixture of actors and non-actors, and so, you know, it's not like we're doing there's not like we've got a massive number of roles each time. But also because with actors, no matter how much you love someone, they have to be right for the part, you know. So Shirley is great. I love Shirley, and Shirley has been in a lot of things we've done. And, you know, like someone like, say, Steve and Rob work with quite a lot of different ways because they're playing versions of themselves. But all the things we did with Steve have been built around him. You know, it's not been kind of fortuitous. It's more like, okay, we want to do something with Steve. What should we do? But in general, if you're doing, you've got an idea for a film, you know, you even though you might love actors, they've got to fit those roles, you know. And it's like just one of those things. If you're 20, you can't play someone who's 40, and so on. And so it's like, it's harder to build up that kind of rep theatre without really writing stuff specifically for kind of group of actors.
Yeah. You mentioned Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, obviously. Are we going to see another trip? I heard Trip to Ireland was being rumoured.
Trip to Ireland, definitely not.
No.
The thing is, but I think, look, each time we've done one, the idea has been one, and that's it. And so we only kind of fairly recently done the last one. So at the moment, it's like there's no plan for it. But I think if we were to do one, I think it'd be like Scandinavia maybe, or Greece or something like that. But it's like, if we do one at all, I think it'd be quite a long time off.
It's not a temptation to just go to a glamorous location and eat lots of amazing food.
It is. That's the main reason why we've done three of them. Only intended to be one, but it's too tempting when someone says, "Do you want to go and spend a few months in Italy eating?"
Yeah.
You can't say no.
That's not something I would turn down at all. I'm going to let you go because I realise I'm your last interview and you're desperate to leave. But I just did want to ask: there were reports you were working on a comedy with Sacha Baron Cohen.
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, it was due to happen now, and then it got put back to May, and now it's not. I think it's not going to happen with the timing. So we still hope to make the film, but I don't think it'll be happening with Sacha, unfortunately.
Okay, that's a shame.
Yeah, it would have been fun. It was like a. It was like love. It was like the idea was like a sort of retail fashion billionaire had a bit of a crisis in one of his companies, and so he wants to throw a big party to show he's still the kind of king of the high street, and so it's like it's going to be on a Greek island and Roman amphitheatre, and then everything goes horribly wrong. So it would have been a fun film to do.
Right.
So I'm hoping it might still happen at some point.
Okay, well, fingers crossed, and best of luck with it on the roads, Michael Winterbottom. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that was John Nugent being violently killed there by Michael Winterbottom. just hedging our bets. We've recorded like a dozen of these, just in case. So that's a lot of fun. And should we talk about the reviews then?
Sure.
Let's talk about the reviews.
Pants slate this week.
Pants slate?
Packed slate.
Oh, packed slate this week.
Well, swimming in new films we are.
Well, yeah.
I mean, you know.
There's a few, but the ones we're going to focus on. Are Kingsman, The Golden Circle, and Borg versus McEnroe. Let's start with Kingsman, The Golden Circle, which is, of course, the sequel to Kingsman, The Secret Service.
We should start with Borg McEnroe. Do you know why?
Why?
Resistance is futile.
Well, that's an ace. Stop this guy making a racket, please.
I love it.
Thanks, Helen.
That's the thing about James. You have to give him the service, and then he'll smash it.
Over the
any
net.
Anymore? Anything else?
No, I'd love to give you a backhanded compliment, but unfortunately, I can't. Should we start with Borg versus McEnroe, which, of course, is the tale of the titanic struggle between Bjorn Borg, not Star Trek Borg, but Bjorn Borg, and John McEnroe in the 1980 Wimbledon men's final, which I don't remember watching. A little bit young for that, but, you know, I'm pretty sure it was a good game. And the film stars Shia LaBeouf as John McEnroe. I mean, intrigued by that, Helen. How did it turn out?
I can't give away the end of the match. Come on.
No, of course not. We wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah, you know. All right. This is the story of the second greatest rivalry in men's tennis, obviously behind Federer and Nadal.
Yes. Such a Federer fan girl.
I am. We had established this last week. So it's in the build-up to and the surroundings of the 1980 Wimbledon final. Millions of people obviously watching worldwide. One of the most famous tennis matches of all time. Obviously surpassed by Federer versus Nadal. There we go.
There we go.
But they were sworn rivals. So you had Bjorn Borg, the sort of Swedish kind of clockwork, you know, beautifully technical tennis player, and then you had the sort of the fiery super brat, he was called at the time, John McEnroe, who was obviously famous for his bad behaviour on court, his inability to control himself.
You cannot be serious.
I am serious, Chris.
Okay.
Just checking. Thank you. So Borg was headed for a fifth straight Wimbledon title. McEnroe was still after number one. Mm-hmm. And it's all the sort of the build up to that and the pressures of fame on Bjorn Borg in particular. McEnroe being irritated by everyone's perception of him and the fact that everybody keeps asking him what he thinks of Bjorn Borg every time he's interviewed, which is, you know, understandably a little bit irritating. So it sort of, sets up the clash between them. So the film focuses, and this might surprise you given the relative levels of fame of the two leads, the film focuses more on Borg than McEnroe.
Borg is played by...
Now, why would you make me, you know, pronounce these names that I can't pronounce? Sverrir Gudnason?
I'll take it.
Thank you. But he's very, very good. But it's definitely much more about him. I mean, McEnroe's backstory, which is, you know, sort of why his parents, you know, putting all this pressure on him, being very overbearing, is like sort of gotten out of the way super fast. And then Borg, we get a lot more from. So we see him as a young boy having the same kind of rants that we see from McEnroe, but basically getting put out of, or getting to learn better than to do that, which, you know, McEnroe maybe hasn't learned to channel his rage the same way. And it kind of leads up to all that final. And the problem here is, and I think this is peculiar to tennis movies in particular, maybe football as well, it's really hard to do the matches brilliantly.
Yeah, it is.
I don't think I've ever tried.
I just said they're really definitive. Yes, it is.
Yes, it definitely is. Yeah. And I think it's interesting, like, not to give anything away, but Battle of the Sexes, another period tennis movie coming up. Yeah. There's very little tennis playing in it, I think, for that reason. And I think here as well, there's the focus is on everything around the tennis, which is probably a wise decision. It's quite art house in some of its sensibility. It doesn't feel like a big sports movie with all the usual kind of cliches and metaphors. But it really suffers, I think, from the fact that it doesn't feel like an even-handed affair between the two players. You want this to really be sort of 50-50, and it isn't, I think. So we give it 3 stars.
Yeah, 50%. We give it 50%. 3 stars for Borg versus McEnroe, which is, of course, as we say on the Emperor podcast, a racket mendation.
Oh, God.
So there we go. And then we'll segue smoothly onto Kingsman: The Golden Circle, which, as I said, is a sequel to Kingsman: The Secret Service, and stars Taron Egerton once again as Kingsman's secret agent, boy from the streets, Eggsy. And he's battling evil, isn't he, Jimbo? What's happening in this?
He is battling Julianne Moore's drug kingpin, Poppy. And that's basically the setup, isn't it? It's more chaos in it. I don't want to give too much away because it's quite easy. Yeah. I think if you get into the plot, I don't even want to get into it at all. I think you just want to leave it there, don't you? Because if you start bringing in everything after the whiskey bottle, it's all a bit of a spoiler.
Well, no, I mean, so, I think everybody knows in this one, we meet the American statesmen, who are the American equivalent of the Kingsmen.
Which is what I was not going to say, but sure.
No, but
I think that's
on the posters. Like, we can admit that much.
Fine, yes.
I'm not going to say how they come into it, but they are there.
Including Channing Tatum, Halle Berry, Jeff Bridges.
Yep.
Yes.
And Pedro Pascal.
Mm-hmm.
All named after spirits. Well, not just spirits, because was it champagne, tequila, whiskey, and ginger ale?
Ginger ale.
That doesn't really count, does it?
Yeah.
And it is more of this is one of those films where, isn't it? I've found the response to this film absolutely fascinating on Twitter. It has elicited incredible hatred from some people who have decried it as objectively inept and many other things which I would argue are objectively untrue. It is a Marmite movie to end all Marmite movies. It will absolutely prompt hatred from many, and others will think it's absolutely hilarious.
Matthew Vaughan told me, because I worked on the feature for the magazine, and in doing that, I spoke to Matthew Vaughan, and he gave me a quote that he actually wanted to use as a tagline. And I kind of wish they had. He said, if you didn't like the first film, you'll hate this one. And so far, from what I can see, that has been borne out. But
except I like this one better than the first one.
That's interesting to me.
Yeah. I still have issues with a certain thing that happens early on.
It could be called problematic in certain areas.
There are definitely problematic areas, definitely. Some of the problematic areas I find less problematic than last time, which will surprise some people.
I'm really looking forward to a spoiler special, by the way. genuinely, we've set aside 90 minutes for it, which should tell you how much I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be intriguing.
But I quite enjoyed some of what happened. I think we can also probably say, and I don't think this is a spoiler, that Eggsy is still in a relationship with Princess Tilde.
Yes, indeed.
Who he obviously, how can I put this, wooed at the end of the last film.
They had a real meet cute, didn't they?
Yes.
They really did.
Is that meat with an A? Never mind. Don't ask
me how I'm spelling meat there, but they're together.
But they're together, and that actually does give it a different flavour, and it did give it one of the funniest scenes, I thought, which is seeing a super spy on the phone to his girlfriend saying, look, I have to seduce this woman to save the world. So, like, is that okay? Like, are we okay if I do that? That, I thought, was genuinely funny.
It also had some very, very good action. I don't want to get too much into this because we're doing a spoiler special in a couple of days.
But
it has some extraordinary action set pieces in it, not least of all the one at the very beginning involving a black cab, which I thought was particularly well shot.
Very cool.
Yeah, I think there are some flaws here. It's a little bit overstuffed. It has some of that sequel-itis thing where you just cram so many characters into the movie. It's probably 10, 15 minutes too long. But I really, really liked the first movie. I thought the first movie was audacious. It gave me things on the cinema screen I hadn't seen before. I'm not entirely sure the second one goes for that, and I think it's a deliberate thing. But what it does do is it gives you a hell of a lot of fun. There are things that happen in this movie that will shock people, appall others, offend others, and leave some people laughing in disbelief. I had an absolute blast with it, but I'm really looking forward to getting into our differing viewpoints, shall we say, on the spoiler special. But I think Taron Egerton's fantastic. I think the American guest stars perhaps don't get enough time to make a huge impact.
I agree.
Julianne Moore is very, very funny as the bad guy, and there's reliable support from the likes of Mark Strong in there as well as Merlin, and we're tiptoeing around a certain someone, but just watch the film and see what, and
that other person's great.
The other person is very, very good, and we'll talk about that more. We give it 4 stars. It is, in my opinion, certainly an absolute blast from beginning to end, and it will divide people, that's for sure. So 4 stars then for Kingsman: The Golden Circle. Sorry we couldn't get into it more, but we don't have a lot of time. I wanna give Phil the send off.
No,
this man
don't
deserves.
Say that.
Quite frankly,
Phil, the second best Phil after Punxsutawney Phil.
Our favourite.
That puts you ahead of Phil Connors, though.
It does. Okay.
Great.
This is true. Phil, you are leaving us. You're leaving not just the podcast after 5.5 years, but you're leaving Empire.
After how many years?
I think it's nearly 10 years.
Ten years. You can do less than that for manslaughter.
Yes. So I didn't need to kill that
person. In retrospect, just taking the sentence.
When we had the podcast on Saturday,
yeah.
For some reason, by the end of it, I come out as someone that had killed 4 people and had hidden their bodies.
You had,
and
is
yet to be.
I mean,
well, I don't know how
the
that
truth
happened,
will
but
out.
I've
Phil.
Never killed anyone. I wouldn't dream of it.
Sure.
All right.
Okay.
So we have a number of questions, and I mean a lot of questions.
Have we?
From listeners, a lot of whom are very, very sad to see you go. Believe me, none as sad as us. Here's one from John Nugent.
John Nugent.
It's the first
just
one. Just an innocent listener.
It's genuinely the first one I've seen. Who will you miss the most from the Empire team, and why is the answer me?
Who will I miss most from the Empire team, and why is the answer John Nugent?
Yeah.
That is a metaphysical question. Why will I miss? I mean, I miss everyone from the Empire team. Obviously, what a great bunch of people. I've loved working. There's been a few down the years who've gone through this portal to the afterworld.
Yes.
Like yes.
I'm about to go through, and I miss them too to this day.
I always feel sad when I see
Alexander Plum. That guy,
Alexander Plum.
Oh, Alex. Him. I remember
wasn't
Alex.
Wasn't he Andrew?
Do you remember him?
I thought he was Andrew.
It was Plume, wasn't it?
Plume.
Yeah. Alexander Plume.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I've been very lucky with the people that I've worked with. They've been amazing. Love everyone in the office. John is a top man, no question.
Why'd you go northern there?
Did I go northern?
You went northern.
Didn't mean to.
Okay.
I didn't mean to.
Do you mean top man in like a Marcus Brody kind of way?
Yeah, top men.
Top men.
One of our top men?
Yeah.
What, you mean you'll never see him, he'll disappear? It does, doesn't he? I just sent him to Spain.
That's it.
You were like, where's John gone?
He knew all the local customs.
And he did.
With any luck, he's got the grill already.
Exactly.
So I love these moments when I wave people off from the podcast and from Empire, and it's like, go on, run along, earn more money, you know, be happier. And then we just stay here, don't we? Just forever.
Well, Chris, you know.
Wait a second.
Anyway, off you go.
What? You left?
Yeah, I know. Back. I left, but I didn't really.
You just went round the building and reported back. This.
I'm just wearing glasses now and a fake tash.
I don't know Helen O'Hara. I'm Hara O'Helen. All right. So here's another question for Phil. This is from Bill McConkie. Who's done the best drawing of you holding a phone?
Oh my lord, Bill McConkie.
Hey.
But a different Bill McConkie. Bill McConkie. For those who aren't aware, is an Empire, an esteemed Empire illustrator. And this was a illustration he did of me for an advertorial that we did with a telecom provider. And I had to do a pose where I was in the office, where I was holding my phone like I was interviewing or taking a picture of a major Hollywood celebrity on a red carpet. And it would be illustrated for the page in the magazine. What I hadn't realised was it was going to be illustrated with me pointing my phone at the bum of a major Hollywood starlet. And so the page came back and I was just like, this makes me look like a massive sex pervert weirdo. Is there any way we could temper that slightly?
Yeah, because
you're like a moderate size sex pervert weirdo.
Just moderate the keep the sex pervert part, just the weirdo can be shelved. And I think Bill, it wasn't Bill's idea, I'm sure, but they just added a bloke to that. So I was just an indiscriminate sex weirdo pervert. But anyway, that was fun. And so the answer to that question is Bill, because he's probably the only one, but he also is a very fine illustrator.
John Larson at JR Larson asks, is there any filmmaker you'd like to play at chess on a beach?
Is this asking which filmmaker most resembles death?
Yeah, there's a number of ways of interpreting it.
Yeah, it's weird.
Who do you think would be good at chess? I'm not very good at chess.
William Sadler.
William Sadler is not a filmmaker, though, is he?
Yeah.
No, I know, but yeah.
Okay.
But he is death.
But he is death in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
Yeah. You should play him at Battleship.
You've been battleshipping.
Yeah.
There's two out of three.
There's three out of five.
You sunk my battleship.
You can see what we're going to lose when Arnhouse Phil goes from this podcast that the death James went to was William Sadler and not Max von Sydow.
Do you know what? You should play someone like David Lynch or Werner Herzog, because I feel like
it'd be amazing.
Because I feel like they'd get distracted from the game by like a passing bird or just the nature existence.
Yeah. Terrence Malick. Porpoise,
exactly.
And I could like take his queen.
Exactly. It'd be fine.
Put it in my pocket when he's not.
So you want one of those guys? You want somebody a little bit out there?
David Lynch would be moving knights. Not knights, he'd be moving bishops sideways, wouldn't he? Be going, I don't believe in rules!
Exactly.
And all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and he'd insist on drawing the board on the back of a cow. I mean, it'd be amazing.
Why not? Why the hell not? Sergeant Peachfuzz, not his real name, asks, favourite and most hated Chris Hewitt impressions?
this is
such a good question.
Well, we know the most hated.
I was thinking about this the other day. Like, there's been an evolution of terrible office banter and impressions down the years. There was a period I enjoyed, and I don't think this was more my brother that drove it than Chris, but there was the when Mark Cousins did his epochal, I think it's fair to say, story of film documentary, there was a long period where we didn't go 5 minutes without someone breaking into this man and this probably the most famous filmmaker in the world, and then just mention some like,
there really is a wonderful Mark Cousins impression. It's very dark and everybody.
Nick's is better.
No, mine's much better.
Do you remember further back than that, the Christopher Walken period, the two mice?
Two mice.
Yeah.
That was
that lasted and a long time.
And two mice.
And you doing
foul and do foul claim.
And like, Chris's Ian McKellen from The Golden Compass as well was one.
Yeah,
that was
I like Ian McKellen.
All right.
I like David Thewlis.
Yep.
His terrible experiments.
Mm-hmm.
What else? I know that the people want me to say the word that rhymes with Ranny Doyle, but I'm not going to. Al Pacino's fun. Not all bad. Right, okay. Some of them are just shambolic.
Well,
I've enjoyed most of them though, quite a lot. Danny Boyle's the most physical. Probably, yeah. You could argue too physical.
You could.
It's a little in your space.
I can't help it. When Danny Boyle enters me, I have to.
Oh, no.
What?
As your lawyer, Chris. As your lawyer.
You still his lawyer?
Yeah. Well, yeah, unfortunately.
Helen's on retainer.
Jacketing.
Constantly.
How do you think I pay
the
bills?
In the morning. What Helen, else? If I say Danny Boyle enters me, is that bad or good? What is that okay? That's okay. I think that's all right. I'm going with it.
What am I missing?
All right, enough about my impressions. It's fine. Let's move on to another question from @SackTheKiwi, who asks, why have you forsaken us, Philcat?
That's biblical. I'm not Jesus, and I'm not dying.
You look a bit like Jesus. You've got the beard.
Oh, the beard's there, and I'm
you're going
my hair's
to the great
long.
Art House Clubhouse.
And I did three miracles
sky.
This morning. One of them was getting to work. Why have I forsaken everyone? I haven't. Love everyone. And I'll just be over there doing other filmy things, but I'll still be part of the family. Will I? As our lawyer? Family lawyer?
Sure.
Sort of.
It was Camden, wasn't it? There was one piercing too many
Camden.
And you just couldn't deal with it.
Yeah, I don't think the questioner wants me to get into the actual mechanics of my career progression or whatever, but... yeah, no, I mean, leaving Empire has been... leaving Empire has been the greatest blessing in my life. Let me rephrase that. Being at Empire has been the greatest thing that's happened to me in my working life, and it's not an easy place to leave, put it that way. And I will be sad and melancholy and nostalgic in equal measure. But, you know, exciting new opportunity. I'll miss the podcast. It's been great. We had 5 years when I was there when there was no podcast, and then 5 years since we had a podcast... were better.
Yeah, I agree.
Just coincidentally.
I agree.
We should make clear, just for anybody who didn't listen the other week, you are going to Time Out to become the film editor at Time Out London.
Why would everyone know that? I'm going to be the film editor at Time Out, yes.
So anyway.
Yeah, that's the other play. I'm not actually going to the afterlife.
Okay, the next question is from an @ChrisHewittLFC who asks, can I have a job?
Chris Hewitt LFC. Now, Chris, you have two Twitter accounts, don't you?
No, I was ad-libbing that. It was just an amusing, improvised joke, Phil.
Oh, I see what you've done there.
See? Anyway, next question is from @Robin, and I do have two Twitter accounts, yes. @RobinTheOffice, could you please pitch to us an art house Marvel movie?
I spotted this one on Twitter, and I had a think about maybe doing a Black Widow movie, but in the style of Tarkovsky.
Amazing.
Where it's just a lot of... It sort of slips between, obviously... dark monochrome and sort of muted colours, and it's just her kind of in the forests of Russia.
Yes, yeah, super on for it.
You wouldn't want to pin down where, because she's Black Widow, right?
Obviously.
And it's just her childhood, like, how did she get into the tight clothes and the kung fu shit?
Yeah. Is there a lake or is there a mirror?
Palimpsestically, like... thinking about how, you know, emotional development, cutting back and forth in timelines, and then Bruce Banner turns up, but it's not Bruce Banner. It's a goat. And then there's 47 different post-credits things, each one more confusing than the last. And it goes on for... It's actually quite economical for a Tarkovsky. It's probably about 7 hours.
Super.
So that would be my art house.
Kevin Feige, if you're listening, just drop us a line. Just drop us a line. We'll put you in touch with Chris.
So maybe that will do the job for me.
Sounds good to me. Sorry, some of these questions I hadn't seen before, so I was laughing at them as I saw them. So here's one from Elbows_Selbo. Shag, marry, kill.
Oh my god.
Tarkovsky, Herzog, the Dardenne brothers.
I don't want to.
Okay. Shag, marry, kill. Go on, Phil.
As your lawyer, you can't marry two brothers.
Yeah, I see.
Because that would be bigamy.
Rules me right out of.
So. Although, what a honeymoon night that would be. Imagine it.
No.
Do I have to?
We've actually broken Phil. Amazing.
Man. Shag, marry, kill.
Yeah.
The Tarkovsky. Well, he's dead, so that's weird.
All right.
Are we assuming they're all alive?
I mean,
they're all alive. They're in the prime of their
physicality,
virility.
Well, actually, Tarkovsky was very handsome as a younger man. I'm not even kidding. He was.
I mean, pillow talk would be upsetting. I'm like, now's not the time to confront our mortality, Werner. I know, I'm sorry, I'm going to take the fifth on that one. They're all magical figures. I'm sorry.
Boo.
It's just too weird.
He would all three to all three of them.
Right, possibly.
All right.
That explains the four bodies.
Ah.
Ha ha ha.
Monty H. Withnell asks, in your time working at Empire, are there any films you reviewed for the magazine or the podcast that you have now changed your mind about?
Monty, you're a terrible c***. I don't know, Chris, have you?
Is that the first time we've had the C word in the podcast? Probably not.
I've been on it, so certainly not.
We had a letter complaint recently about you.
Did you?
Yeah.
Really?
Saying, it was a gentleman, he said, I used to listen to my the podcast with my 8-year-old son and really enjoyed it, but every time James Dyer is on it, I cannot listen to the podcast because you're so sweary.
Oh, I'd say I thought it would have nothing to do with my swearing.
No, just your general awful opinions.
Yeah, absolutely that. I'm just offensive. It's fair comment.
This is not news to anyone here.
I don't have a Attack of the Clones, Revenge of the Sith in my locker. Because I haven't reviewed...
Who does?
I haven't reviewed anything quite on that, you know, scale of polarity. But not really, I'll be honest. I mean, certainly I've seen films that I've changed my opinion of. But, oh gosh, what would they be? I really hated The Rock when I first saw it.
What's wrong with you?
I don't know. I went to see it in the cinema on the King's Road, and I came out and there was a bloke there. This never happened. And he said, did you like the film? And I said, no, not really. And he went, do you want to go and see another one instead? I said, sure. I can't remember what I went to see.
Was it like The Shopkeeper from Mr. Ben?
Why did I not like it? Yeah, it was unusual. Maybe that was in my imagination. But no, I mean, not in my reviews. Because it would be a very good review, would you, if you like completely change your mind on a film that you've reviewed.
Well, why?
I mean, you're supposed to, like, I don't know.
We're only human.
I guess we make mistakes.
Opinions change. Times change. Maybe you leave years between a film and maybe it percolates a little bit. And maybe you rewatch it a few years later and go, Christ. Christ, this is awful. The arena scene is okay. The bit where Django gets his head chopped off is quite fun, but...
Chris, I feel like you're suddenly being talking very specifically rather than hypothetically.
No, I'm just using this as an example. I don't even know the film I'm talking about.
No, there probably isn't. Ooh.
Django. Django is a very common name in movies.
Super common. I can think of two.
Mark Levy Art asks, very sad to hear this news. How do you cope with having a brother who thinks he is famous because you can see him on a freeze frame in Jurassic World?
Oh, ouch.
I mean, Nick's ego did explode after that, didn't it? Are you in a film, Phil? Have you ever been close to being in a film?
I once walked into the frame on a film set, but that's different.
What film? What happened?
It was...
Was it the one about the Nazis?
No, the one about the Nazis. it was Alicia Vikander.
The one about the Nazis?
Not about the Nazis. It was the wrong war.
Oh.
It was
the one about
Testament
the Germans.
Of Youth.
Right.
Testament of Youth. I was just... I was talking to someone significant on set. I was doing an interview and there was just laughter from like the video village area of everyone was gathered around pissing themselves. And we were like, what is it? And there was Alicia Vikander acting and then in the background there's just me asking, you know, what attracted this person to the material. You're working on a pretty tight schedule on this movie, aren't you? You've got to turn it around in a certain number of days whilst ruining another take.
They removed you in a post-production effects shot. That's
I watched the film and I'd hoped that they'd forgotten to in an unprecedented blooper, but unfortunately... maybe on the blooper reel. I don't think there's a blooper reel on Testament of Youth. It's all about the tragedy of wasted youth in the First World War. Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Anyway. So yeah.
At FBL.
Wait, I didn't answer the question.
What was the question?
How do you deal with?
Oh, right. Yes. Sorry, I thought you had.
Yeah, fine. As long as you don't make eye contact, all is well.
Yes. You have to speak through an intermediary.
Mm-hmm.
At FBL Havda asks. This is a tough one. This is Sophie's choice for you here, Phil.
Mm-hmm.
Goddard or Melville?
Melville.
Whoa.
Oh, no, that's super easy.
Sophie didn't lean into her choice that easily, did she?
Yeah, take the younger one.
I don't care.
No, I much prefer Melville. I mean, Goddard is... I mean, he's probably more... I don't know. I mean, there's probably film scholars that would disagree with this. I don't know, maybe. But I think Goddard's maybe more influential in terms of his style of editing and such like. With Budu Sufe. I don't think Melville has a film quite of that impact. Mm-hmm. But I love his films the most.
And also Moby
Dick. Great Melville. Moby Dick's a great book. Yeah. I wish he'd made that. He should have done that himself. made the melded his sort of gangster
Melville
with...
on Melville.
Mm. yeah, anyway, so if you haven't seen Jean-Pierre Melville films or books or Wales,
yeah,
you should because they're really good, especially Le Samurai and Army of Shadows.
Here's another one from @Sean1Neo. Any chance of making a surprise appearance in the Emperor podcast in future?
As my lawyer, I don't think I'm not sure I'm allowed to. I mean, I haven't seen much of Ali Plum.
You will be going, you're working for a different
Andrew
company.
Plum. I think that might be tricky, but you never know. Never say never.
Yes.
Never say never.
Never say never. Best starstruck moment at Empire. He was cheeky, had two questions.
Probably last time I saw my brother. don't know. I don't know about you guys. I mean, this isn't meant to sound entitled because I'm always blown away by these impressive people that you meet. But having done it for 10 years, I interviewed Johnny Depp early on. Sort of the statutory 3.5 minutes or whatever.
His
entourage circling. And there's something about him, or at least there was before everyone, anyway, so that was I was a bit starstruck then, but I guess after 10 years, it's difficult to do your job if you're starstruck, you have to try and pretend not to be at least.
Yeah. Mm.
So, and also because the environment in which we interview people is quite weird and hermetic, I find that I've probably said this before, but you'll go and interview like Nick Cage and the Dorchester or whatever, and then you'll come outside and that'll be all kind of standard, I suppose, and then you'll come outside and spot Bill Oddie in the street and completely lose your shit. So there's something about seeing people in the wild where I think
do you get like I do, because I don't get starstruck with film people, but I do get starstruck with sports stars and musicians. Are you like that?
Yeah, I would be, definitely. I mean, I asked this question as a pint of milk question, actually, isn't it? And I asked Alexander Skarsgård this when I interviewed him a few months ago, and he said that pretty much, most movie people have other movie people that they would be starstruck by, and he said that he was much more he sports a very by his own admission a very rubbish Swedish football team in second division. He says anytime he meets any of the players he completely loses it. which I can relate to. I mean, it is, definitely. Those instances,
and it's different when you meet people in a social situation, as you say.
Yeah.
And suddenly you're relying on your powers of small talk. And my powers of small talk are feeble at best.
None.
They're Lilliputian, my small talk. This is dwarfed.
It's not good.
Yeah.
Do you guys have anything you want to ask Phil?
I don't have a question, but I will share one of my favourite Phil Empire moments, which is when Phil used to sit behind me when we were at our old office in Dever House, and he was doing one of Empire's famous How Much Is a Pint of Milk interviews with one Monsieur Eric Cantona. And when it got to the famous question, how hairy is your arse on a scale of 1 to 10? Not only did the response to that him say, how hairy is my arse, which was not the question, but Phil forgot to add the suffix on a scale of 1 to 10. What he in fact asked Eric was, please describe the topography of your buttocks using as many adjectives as you can think of. Which was quite special.
Why do you think that was an accident? I'm just curious.
Perhaps you were very curious. Yes. You said, with a kind of rough shag.
Might have a seagull sardine analogy for me. Yeah, that was pretty special. It wasn't good. I mean, when I turned around, I could see the office behind me, but it was like, what's that game where you turn around and everyone creeps up behind you? What's that called?
Serial killing.
Yes.
But you would do this. I mean,
everyone was listening.
And you still do it, actually, as recently as I can tell, and that you will actually do phone interviews in the office on the office phone. I mean, now we've changed our phone system, so you probably don't do it anymore, but with people listening in, which I absolutely cannot do.
Yeah.
Just cannot do it, which is kind of weird given how public the podcast interviews are, but I cannot have anyone listening to my phone interview technique. But you're out there. You did Joan Collins for Pint of Milk in front of the office. And it was incredibly ballsy of you to do
that. Why am I ballsy guy? I'm going testicles. I'll be appearing in the Matt Damon movie.
Slapping them on the desk.
No, I don't know. I just, there wasn't any alternative. You go home or I don't know, sit on the roof or something. I don't know where you go. Where's Chris?
Yeah, I'm with
He's left the office for 4 days to do an interview with a phoner. I mean, we didn't have much alternative. So you sort of get used to it. It's not ideal, admittedly, but now we're in an office where there's more opportunity not to do that. Mostly it's not ideal because somebody would have to stand up and say, can everyone not use the C word for the next 25 minutes, please?
Yeah.
Which shouldn't need to be said, but there you go.
But it's Empire, so...
We literally used to have a sign
for
that, please stop swearing, I'm doing radio, or I'm doing a phone.
Well, it can be, it could be a bit, you know, orcs, should we say, but no, I didn't really mind that too much. You know, just... allow everyone to revel in my poor interviewing technique.
It's just a tiny thing. It's a tiny thing.
I want to take this opportunity to thank Phil for always snaffling the G2 crossword
still
for
doing
me
it.
From
Russell, what you've got
from the Guardian that gets sent to the office. So,
yeah, we
thanks.
Get a copy of the Guardian.
Yeah, we do.
And
he actually reads it.
I kind of read the Guardian and I cut out their G2 because it's got crosswords and Sudokus.
Exactly.
Which you can do when Chris is saying inappropriate things on the podcast.
Another thing I love about you, there are many things obviously, is the way that you would just switch off in the middle of a podcast. Absolutely. If you guys have done this, where suddenly Phil is just, I've literally seen you sometimes, where Helen and I might be monologuing a little bit, and literally you will be suddenly like, you'll just start scratching your beard really loudly and just kind of into the microphone.
Or rubbing it against the microphone, which
you
did. Once.
You did this. I mean, I was watching Phil at the corner of my eye and he just started doing this, if you can hear this. He just started scratching his facial hair against the microphone.
I didn't have a beard back then.
It was absolutely
amazing.
Yeah,
that's possibly true.
No, it was.
You might have been doing it about sort of phase 12 of the Marvel Cinematic Universe at the time. Possible.
It's glorious. It's glorious.
Yeah. Anyway,
do you have a favourite podcast moment? Do you have someone that you met that you didn't think you would meet, and then the podcast facilitated that? Or, you know, is this your favourite podcast moment? Because this is it. It's done, and you won't be doing this shit any longer.
I can't cope with the idea that I won't ever, like, in my mind, there'll be others. I'll be back next week, and then I'll go away and I'll just slowly absorb the fact that I won't.
Mm. Surely it's the moment you got Cara Delevingne to sing the Pokemon theme tune.
That was pretty good. I enjoyed that. Although that was, I mean, she had a lot of people in the room and it was a bit weird, that whole podcast. But she was really good, a really good sport.
And she selfied with you as well, didn't she?
She did a selfie with me, Which is kind of how I ended up meeting my partner, Taff, because I posted that picture on.
Really?
She messaged me on Facebook and said, I don't know, she just mentioned the Cara Delevingne thing and we kind of like started talking from there on.
I did not know that. So Cara Delevingne is your matchmaker.
Worth mentioning is that she was in Sydney at the time. And So she's still in Sydney. No, she's moved to London.
This is a screenplay right here.
Hang on. Yeah.
Hang on, you need to send her a thank you note. You need to send Cara Delevingne
a thank
you
note. When we get married, as and when, but I think that might somewhat overshadow event, and I'm also not. She's the sort of person that might just turn up.
I mean, she gatecrashed a podcast we did with Margot Robbie. She just stormed into the middle of it once.
Yeah, she's pretty out there, and I liked her, but she's a bit of a wild child. And we called her Our Lady of Delevingne or something, because we sort of saw her as this weird kind of patron saint of our getting together.
Wow,
I guess
that's amazing.
That is amazing.
Never mind Cara Delevingne taking credit for this. The Empire podcast should take credit.
You guys
for this.
Should take
this
amazing. Totally.
If we have achieved anything in 5.5 years, getting Phil together with his girlfriend, and as people, know in the podcast.
So there is a podcast baby.
The podcast has
had a baby. This is amazing.
Is your child not called Bangly Bang? What's going on? Bangly Bang, the Sam Leon's a great name.
Yeah. Bangly Bang.
It is, in fact, a recommendation.
There's still time to reconsider.
it's our baby recommendation.
That is a recommendation.
That was a good one.
Ali Plume, formerly of this podcast.
Alex
Plume of this podcast, formerly of this podcast, asked me to remind you about the Meryl Streep situation.
Oh, my word, yes.
Can you explain to the listeners what the Meryl Streep situation was?
I think Meryl Streep's situation was we went to interview Meryl Streep in a hotel, me and Ali, about Florence Foster Jenkins, or maybe it was the film before that she was doing.
I think it was the film before that.
Actually, I was starstruck by Meryl Streep, actually, in fairness, in answer to your earlier question, because... Meryl Streep, and Ali, and the batteries ran out on our audio equipment, which is such an unusual thing to happen, a technical snafu like that happened to us on the Empire podcast when we're out and about doing interviews that at least 50% of the time go wrong. Ali had to run down the corridor to get some more batteries and just left me in the room with Meryl Streep, and I hadn't really planned I was a bit overawed should we say. But then she kind of like was like, you know, do you want a cup of tea? And I was like, yeah, that'd be nice. And she got up and just made me a cup of tea. And then as I remember, Ali kind of came back and went, oh, I've forgotten something else, and then went away again. And I was just like, but that may not have happened. That may not have happened.
Did you and I have the same problem with Alexander Payne?
Alexander
Payne.
Was that
you and me for Alexander a film of his?
I think we might have done that.
I think my favourite example of something like that happening was when Ali and I went to interview the star of Bosch, Titus Welliver. Mm. Thank you, James. You just looked at me there and I remembered his name.
My face.
Your face is Warren. And we turned up to interview him, and the Marantz, the portable recorder that we used sometimes to record interviews when we're not in the studio, had either been stolen or had fallen out of the bag on the way to the interview because it wasn't there. We had lost it. Luckily, Titus Welliver, bless him, is an amazing guy and a huge fan of Empire, so he was more than happy for us to go away, find something to record him with, and then come back. That's embarrassing. It's like it literally had fallen out of the bag, or I still think to this day someone had half-finished it. But
wow.
When but Nick and I did David Ayer for Suicide Squad, Ayer was in the middle of like pouring his heart out on how he'd really been hurt by the critical reception. Oh, and wow. I was the only one with headphones on, and literally just half I just heard it just go... And it stopped. And he carried on talking, and Nick was still talking to him. And then neither of them noticed. And I thought, do I just not say anything? And I just really subtly reached into my bag for some other batteries and kind of swapped them over and hoped that no one noticed.
Oh, boy. Oof.
We lost a couple of minutes, but we salvaged the interview.
But it was gold. It was gold. The stuff we lost wasn't gold. All right, so just a couple of last questions from readers, and we'll let everyone go home. This is a good one. From MickWord75, what's the one movie you'd watch forever in purgatory?
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Okay. That's a shorter answer than I was expecting. But,
what were you expecting?
No, I was expecting, like, you know, reasonings and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, some reasonings.
No, it's fine. At Christmas Turner asks, what's the artiest house ever portrayed on screen?
Ooh.
The artiest house ever portrayed on screen. I mean, I don't have a funny answer for this one. I would say that if you were being literal, the Bates Motel in Psycho was kind of influenced by Edward Hopper.
Yeah.
I would also say that if you ever get the chance to look online, there's an amazing documentary with interview with Billy Wilder where at his house in LA, and his house is literally his ass is literally covered in
how airy is his
house not us is literally covered in like Rembrandts and Picassos, and I mean it's nuts, like wall to wall. So that's not a film obviously, but he was something of he's by his own admission a complete hoarder of art, rather than even a collector. He just liked to hoard things. But I don't know, what do you think? Got any funny answer to that one?
I had an idea and it's gone out of my head. Last year, Tom Ford, Amy Adams.
Oh yeah, Single Man. No.
No.
Oh, the night.
Nocturnal Animals. Thank you. That, because it had like a Coons in the garden, and it had all this kind of art and such. So that might be a good one.
That's a good one. That is a good one. I think we've exhausted all the questions from listeners, and if you guys have said everything else that you need to say to this man. Any more questions? Anything you want to say to him?
Somebody wondered about the Steve Jobs cinematic universe.
Yeah, I skipped past that one.
But,
yeah.
There may be news.
Is there news?
No.
There's no news. That's why I skipped past it.
I mean, as a freelancer, I would like to say, look forward to working with you at Time I.
Yeah, anyone? Any pitches?
No, I look forward to reading whatever it is that you're doing over that. I hesitate to call it a magazine. What is it? it is a magazine. Okay. And a website, of course. No, I'm very excited for you, Phil. It's amazing. James, anything to say to this man?
I shall miss Phil enormously. Yes, I've sat with Phil for many years. We've been through trials, tribulations, premieres, festivals, Empire Awards, Big Screen, Empire Live, and many other things that I've spent hours talking to my therapist about. And I don't think any of these things, were I to have to go through them again, would be the same without Phil.
So no.
Empire will be a darker place without you.
What festivals?
I know, probably the London Film Festival. We didn't go very far, did we?
the one that you well thanks James.
Yeah,
I feel the same way, and I want to say thank you to everyone that's put up with some of my random ruminations on the podcast down the years.
Where am I going to go
inspire at least one person to watch a Kira Kurosawa's Dozu.
Yeah, it isn't me. But where am I going to go with my questions about the Wehrmacht? You know, it's things like that that I will miss.
I don't
want
to be known as like a multi.
You're like the Nazi expert. I don't know quite.
Nazi expert.
I mean, your brother just doesn't have that level of Nazi knowledge, and I can't really replace that easily.
I don't know. You'll find me. You'll find me on Twitter.
I will.
And Phil Desemlin. And Phil, yes, it's going to be tremendously sad to lose you. You have been an amazing friend and colleague of the last 10 years. You know, it's and you've been such a huge part of the Empire podcast as well, with your art house knowledge and showing us up, frankly, every week. It's going to be wall-to-wall Marvel from now on. As Helen and I,
and
we should
say Phil also likes the mainstream stuff. He likes to point this out occasionally.
I like to.
So I just want to say we will also miss
his
input on the other films.
Yeah, I know some other films too, but
mostly
prefer it when they're subtitled.
Yeah. But sad to see you go, Phil Catt. Final word from you.
Thanks, Simon. Final word from me. Well, in summary, gosh. Well,
we should also say thank you for indulging us. You know, it's not every podcast that someone leaves, especially someone who's had such a momentous impact on Empire and on the podcast over the last few years.
Well, it's been very special, and I'm very sad to
cry, you bastard.
I'm not gonna cry. There's no crying in baseball. There's no crying in podball. I think that there will be tears at some point. I love being on the podcast with you guys. I've had so much fun. It's been often hilarious, occasionally hapless, mostly inspiring.
I think those two are the other way around.
Yeah, well, you know, proportions TBC. Yeah. But Just brilliant. It's a brilliant idea. And I want to mention Ali as well, actually.
Yeah.
Ali Plum, because he was a big driving force in getting this whole thing started. And they did a great job getting it off the ground. And I think... And to the people that come to our live podcasts, I'm not someone that sort of this is all about me, but I do want to say that, you know, that it's been pretty amazing to see people come out and pay good money.
Yeah.
Sometimes bad money, probably.
Yeah.
To come and see us talking nonsense in a variety of live locations, including Edinburgh. That was great.
Mm.
This weekend at the Live London Podcast Festival, the Prince Charles. You guys are awesome. The enthusiasm and excitement and engagement and passion, you know. Mm-hmm. These people out there know way more about films than I do. But it's been a real privilege kind of getting to meet people and occasionally talk at them. So thank you.
It's been incredible, and you will be much missed. And indeed, we want to echo that as well. If you haven't heard last week's podcast, it is the live podcast at the London Podcast Festival with Matthew Vaughan and Mark Strong as our special guests, and was a lot of fun. And we are always blown away when people turn out to see the podcasts. And so if you want to listen to that, the edited highlights, because I think we went off script a little bit, a couple of times.
Us?
It's fine. Yeah. It's fine. It's okay. Hapless and mostly hapless and very occasionally hilarious. So it's been amazing. Phil, you will be missed. And that is it for this week's Empire podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun without this man to my left. Very, very sad days. We will be joined by either Ridley Scott or Denis Villeneuve. One of those two.
Mon Dieu.
That's exciting, isn't it?
Incroyable.
Right, so until that momentous occasion, it is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from James.
Bye.
It's goodbye from me. And it's goodbye for the last time from Phil Desemlin. Phil, take us out.
Goodbye. What am I supposed to do?
Just say thanks for listening. See you next week.
Oh,
or say you never.
See you never.
So you're about to take a time out.
15th of Nevery.
Yeah. Perhaps a poem. Stop all the clocks.
Oh gosh, stop it. Anyway, go well, everyone. Love you all. Bye.